Chapter 12. Investigating Social Dynamics. Power, Conformity, and Obedience. In trying to understand the character transformations of the good young men in the Stanford Prison Experiment, I previously outlined a number of psychological processes that were pivotal in perverting their thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and actions. We saw how the basic need to belong, to associate with, and be accepted by others, so central to community building and family bonding, was diverted in the SPE into conformity with newly emergent norms that enabled the guards to abuse the prisoners. We saw further that the basic motive for consistency between our private attitudes and public behavior allowed for dissonant commitments to be resolved and rationalized in violence against one's fellows. I will argue that the most dramatic instances of directed behavior change and mind control are not the consequence of exotic forms of influence, such as hypnosis, psychotropic drugs, or brainwashing, but rather the systematic manipulation of the most mundane aspects of human nature over time in confining settings. It is in this sense, I believe, what the English scholar C.S. Lewis proposed, that a powerful force in transforming human behavior, pushing people across the boundary between good and evil, comes from the basic desire to be in and not out. If we think of social power as arrayed in a set of concentric circles from the most powerful central or inner ring moving outward to the least socially significant outer ring, we can appreciate his focus on the centripetal pull of that central circle. Lewis's inner ring is the elusive Camelot of acceptance into some special group, some privileged association that confers instant status and enhanced identity. Its lure for most of us is obvious. Who does not want to be a member of the in-group? Who does not want to know that she or he has been tried and found worthy of inclusion in, of ascendance into, a new rarefied realm of social acceptability? Peer pressure has been identified as one social force that makes people, especially adolescents, do strange things, anything, to be accepted. However, the quest for the inner ring is nurtured from within. There is no peer pressure power without that push from self-pressure for them to want you. It makes people willing to suffer through painful, humiliating initiation rites in fraternities, cults, social clubs, or the military. It justifies for many suffering a lifelong existence climbing the corporate ladder. This motivational force is doubly energized by what Lewis called the terror of being left outside. This fear of rejection when one wants acceptance can cripple initiative and negate personal autonomy. It can turn social animals into shy introverts. The imagined threat of being cast into the out-group can lead some people to do virtually anything to avoid their terrifying rejection. Authorities can command total obedience not through punishments or rewards, but by means of the double-edged weapon, the lure of acceptance coupled with the threat of rejection. So strong is this human motive that even strangers are empowered when they promise us a special place at their table of shared secrets, just between you and me. A sordid example of these social dynamics came to light recently when a 40-year-old woman pleaded guilty to having sex with 5 high school boys and providing them and others with drugs and alcohol at weekly sex parties in her home for a full year. She told police that she had done it because she wanted to be a cool mom. In her affidavit, this newly cool mom told investigators that she had never been popular with her classmates in high school, but orchestrating these parties enabled her to begin feeling like one of the group. Sadly, she caught the wrong inner ring. Lewis goes on to describe the subtle process of initiation, the indoctrination of good people into a private inner ring that can have malevolent consequences, turning them into scoundrels. I cite this passage at length because it is such an eloquent expression of how this basic human motive can be imperceptibly perverted by those with the power to admit or deny access to their inner ring. It will set the stage for our excursion into the experimental laboratories and field settings of social scientists who have investigated such phenomena in considerable depth. To 9 out of 10 of you, the choice which could lead to scoundrelism will come, when it does come, in no very dramatic colors. Obviously bad men, obviously threatening or bribing, will almost certainly not appear. Over a drink or a cup of coffee, disguised as a triviality and sandwiched between two jokes, from the lips of a man or woman whom you have recently been getting to know rather better, and whom you hope to know better still, just at the moment when you are most anxious not to appear crude or naive or a prig, the hint will come. It will be the hint of something which is not quite in accordance with the technical rules of fair play, something that the public, the ignorant romantic public, would never understand, something which even the outsiders in your own profession are apt to make a fuss about, but something, says your new friend, which we, and at the word we you try not to blush for mere pleasure, something we always do. And you will be drawn in, if you are drawn in, not by desire for gain or ease, but simply because at that moment, when the cup was so near your lips, you cannot bear to be thrust back again into the cold outer world. It would be so terrible to see the other man's face, that genial, confidential, delightfully sophisticated face, turn suddenly cold and contemptuous, to know that you had been tried for the inner ring and rejected. And then, if you are drawn in, next week it will be something a little further from the rules, and next year something further still, but all in the jolliest, friendliest spirit. It may end in a crash, a scandal, and penal servitude. It may end in millions, a peerage, and giving the prizes at your old school. But you will be a scoundrel. Research Revelations of Situational Power. The Stanford Prison Experiment is a facet of the broad mosaic of research that reveals the power of social situations and the social construction of reality. We have seen how it focused on power relationships among individuals within an institutional setting. A variety of studies that preceded and followed it have illuminated many other aspects of human behavior that are shaped in unexpected ways by situational forces. Groups can get us to do things we ordinarily might not do on our own, but their influence is often indirect, simply modeling the normative behavior that the group wants us to imitate and practice. In contrast, authority influence is more often direct and without subtlety. You do what I tell you to do. But because the demand is so open and bold-faced, one can decide to disobey and not follow the leader. To see what I mean, consider this question. To what extent would a good, ordinary person resist against or comply with the demand of an authority figure that he harm or even kill an innocent stranger? This provocative question was put to experimental test in a controversial study on blind obedience to authority. It is a classic experiment about which you have probably heard because of its shocking effects, but there is much more value embedded in its procedures that we will extract to aid in our quest to understand why good people can be induced to behave badly. We will review replications and extensions of this classic study and again ask the question posed of all such research. What is its external validity? What are real-world parallels to the laboratory demonstration of authority power? Beware. Self-serving biases may be at work. Before we get into the details of this research, I must warn you of a bias you likely possess that might shield you from drawing the right conclusions from all you are about to read. Most of us construct self-enhancing, self-serving, egocentric biases that make us feel special, never ordinary, and certainly above average. Such cognitive biases serve a valuable function in boosting our self-esteem and protecting against life's hard knocks. They enable us to explain away failures, take credit for our successes, and disown responsibility for bad decisions, perceiving our subjective world through rainbow prisms. For example, research shows that 86% of Australians rate their job performance as above average, and 90% of American business managers rate their performance as superior to that of their average peer. Pity that poor average dude. Yet these biases can be maladaptive as well by blinding us to our similarity to others and distancing us from the reality that people just like us behave badly in certain toxic situations. Such biases also mean that we don't take basic precautions to avoid the undesired consequences of our behavior, assuming it won't happen to us. So we take sexual risks, driving risks, gambling risks, health risks, and more. In the extreme version of these biases, most people believe that they are less vulnerable to these self-serving biases than other people, even after being taught about them. That means when you read about the SPE or the many studies in this next section, you might well conclude that you would not do what the majority has done, that you would, of course, be the exception to the rule. That statistically unreasonable belief, since most of us share it, makes you even more vulnerable to situational forces precisely because you underestimate their power as you overestimate yours. You are convinced that you would be the good guard, the defiant prisoner, the resistor, the dissident, the nonconformist, and, most of all, the hero. Would that it were so, but heroes are a rare breed, some of whom we will meet in our final chapter. So I invite you to suspend that bias for now, and imagine that what the majority has done in these experiments is a fair base rate for you as well. At the very least, please consider that you can't be certain of whether or not you could be as readily seduced into doing what the average research participant has done in these studies if you were in their shoes under the same circumstances. I ask you to recall what prisoner Clay, 416, the sausage resistor, said in his post-experimental interview with his tormentor, the John Wayne guard. When taunted with, "What kind of guard would you have been if you were in my place?" he replied modestly, "I really don't know." It is only through recognizing that we are all subject to the same dynamic forces in the human condition, that humility takes precedence over unfounded pride, that we can begin to acknowledge our vulnerability to situational forces. In this vein, recall John Donne's eloquent framing of our common interrelatedness and interdependence. All mankind is of one author and is one volume. When one man dies, one chapter is not torn out of the book, but translated into a better language, and every chapter must be so translated. As therefore the bell that rings to a sermon calls not upon the preacher only, but upon the congregation to come, so this bell calls us all. No man is an island, entire of itself. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Meditations 27. Classic research on conforming to group norms. One of the earliest studies on conformity in 1935 was designed by a social psychologist from Turkey, Muzaffer Sharif. Sharif, a recent immigrant to the United States, believed that Americans in general tended to conform because their democracy emphasized mutually shared agreements. He devised an unusual means of demonstrating conformity of individuals to group standards in a novel setting. Male college students were individually ushered into a totally dark room in which there was a stationary spot of light. Sharif knew that without any frame of reference, such a light appears to move about erratically, an illusion called the autokinetic effect. At first, each of these subjects was asked individually to judge the movement of the light. Their judgments varied widely. Some saw a movement of a few inches, while others reported that the spot moved many feet. Each person soon established a range within which most of his reports would fall. Next, he was put into a group with several others. They gave estimates that varied widely, but in each group a norm crystallized, wherein a range of judgments and an average norm judgment emerged. After many trials, the other participants left, and the individual, now alone, was asked again to make estimates of the movement of the light, the test of his conformity to the new norm established in that group. His judgments now fell in this new group-sanctioned range, departing significantly from his earlier personal range. Sharif also used a Confederate who was trained to give estimates that varied in their latitude from a small to a very large range. Sure enough, the naive subject's autokinetic experience mirrored that of the judgments of this devious Confederate rather than sticking to his previously established personal perceptual standard. Ash's conformity research. Getting into line. Sharif's conformity effect was challenged in 1955 by another social psychologist, Solomon Ash, who believed that Americans were actually more independent than Sharif's work had suggested. Ash believed that Americans could act autonomously even when faced with a majority who saw the world differently from them. The problem with Sharif's test situation, he argued, was that it was so ambiguous, without any meaningful frame of reference or personal standard. When challenged by the alternative perception of the group, the individual had no real commitment to his original estimates, so just went along. Real conformity required the group to challenge the basic perception and beliefs of the individual, to say that X was Y, when clearly that was not true. Under those circumstances, Ash predicted, relatively few would conform. Most would be staunchly resistant to this extreme group pressure that was so transparently wrong. What actually happened to people confronted with a social reality that conflicted with their basic perceptions of the world? To find out, let me put you into the seat of a typical research participant. You are recruited for a study of visual perception that begins with judging the relative size of lines. You are shown cards with three lines of differing lengths and asked to state out loud which of the three is the same length as a comparison line on another card. One is shorter, one is longer, and one is exactly the same length as the comparison line. The task is a piece of cake for you. You make few mistakes, just like most others, less than 1% of the time. But you are not alone in this study. You are flanked by a bunch of peers, 7 of them, and you are number 8. At first, your answers are like theirs, all right on. But then, unusual things start to happen. On some trials, each of them in turn reports seeing the long line as the same length as the medium line, or the short line the same as the medium one. Unknown to you, the other 7 are members of Ash's research team who have been instructed to give incorrect answers unanimously on specific critical trials. When it is your turn, they all look at you as you look at the card with the 3 lines. You are clearly seeing something different than they are, but do you say so? Do you stick to your guns and say what you know is right, or do you go along with what everyone else says is right? You face that same group pressure on 12 of the total 18 trials where the group gives answers that are wrong, but they are accurate on the other 6 trials interspersed into the mix. If you are like most of the 123 actual research participants in Ash's study, you would yield to the group about 70% of the time on some of those critical wrong judgment trials. 30% of the original subjects conformed on the majority of trials, and only a quarter of them were able to maintain their independence throughout the testing. Some reported being aware of the differences between what they saw and the group consensus, but they felt it was easier to go along with the others. For others, the discrepancy created a conflict that was resolved by coming to believe that the group was right and their perception was wrong. All those who yielded underestimated how much they had conformed, recalling yielding much less to the group pressure than had actually been the case. They remained independent, in their minds, but not in their actions. Follow-up studies showed that when pitted against just one person giving an incorrect judgment, a participant exhibits some uneasiness but maintains independence. However, with a majority of 3 people opposed to him, errors rose to 32%. On a more optimistic note, however, Ash found one powerful way to promote independence. By giving the subject a partner whose views were in line with his, the power of the majority was greatly diminished. Peers' support decreased errors to one-fourth of what they had been when there was no partner, and this resistance effect endured even after the partner left. One of the valuable additions to our understanding of why people conform comes from research that highlights two of the basic mechanisms that contribute to group conformity. We conform first out of informational needs. Other people often have ideas, views, perspectives, and knowledge that helps us to better navigate our world, especially through foreign shores and new ports. The second mechanism involves normative needs. Other people are more likely to accept us when we agree with them than when we disagree, so we yield to their view of the world, driven by a powerful need to belong, to replace differences with similarities. Conformity and independence light up the brain differently. New technology, not available in Ash's day, offers intriguing insights into the role of the brain in social conformity. When people conform, are they rationally deciding to go along with the group out of normative needs, or are they actually changing their perceptions and accepting the validity of the new, though erroneous, information provided by the group? A recent study utilized advanced brain scanning technology to answer this question. Researchers can now peer into the active brain as a person engages in various tasks by using a scanning device that detects which specific brain regions are energized as they carry out various mental tasks. The process is known as functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI. Understanding what mental functions various brain regions control tells us what it means when they are activated by any given experimental task. Here's how the study worked. Imagine that you are one of 32 volunteers recruited for a study of perception. You have to mentally rotate images of three-dimensional objects to determine if the objects are the same as or different from a standard object. In the waiting room, you meet four other volunteers, with whom you begin to bond by practicing games on laptop computers, taking photos of one another, and chatting. They are really actors, confederates as they are called in psychology, who will soon be faking their answers on the test trials so that they are in agreement with one another, but not with the correct responses that you generate. You are selected as the one to go into the scanner while the others outside look at the objects first as a group and then decide if they are the same or different. As in Ash's original experiment, the actors unanimously give wrong answers on some trials, correct answers on others, with occasional mixed group answers thrown in to make the test more believable. On each round, when it is your turn at bat, you are shown the answers given by the others. You'll have to decide if the objects are the same or different, as the group assessed them or as you saw them. As in Ash's experiments, you, as the typical subject, would cave in to group pressure, on average giving the group's wrong answers 41% of the time. When you yield to the group's erroneous judgment, your conformity would be seen in the brain scan as changes in selected regions of the brain's cortex dedicated to vision and spatial awareness. Specifically, activity increases in the right intraparietal sulcus. Surprisingly, there would be no changes in areas of the forebrain that deal with monitoring conflicts, planning, and other higher-order mental activities. On the other hand, if you make independent judgments that go against the group, your brain would light up in the areas that are associated with emotional salience, the right amygdala and right caudate nucleus regions. This means that resistance creates an emotional burden for those who maintain their independence. Autonomy comes at a psychic cost. The lead author of this research, the neuroscientist Gregory Burns, concluded that we like to think that seeing is believing, but the study's findings show that seeing is believing what the group tells you to believe. This means that other people's views, when crystallized into a group consensus, can actually affect how we perceive important aspects of the external world, thus calling into question the nature of truth itself. It is only by becoming aware of our vulnerability to social pressure that we can begin to build resistance to conformity when it is not in our best interest to yield to the mentality of the herd. Minority power to impact the majority. Juries can become hung when a dissenter gets support from at least one other person, and together they challenge the dominant majority view. But can a small minority turn the majority around to create new norms using the same basic psychological principles that usually help to establish the majority view? A research team of French psychologists put that question to an experimental test. In a color naming task, if two Confederates among groups of six female students consistently called a blue light green, almost a third of the naive majority subjects eventually followed their lead. However, the members of the majority did not give in to the consistent minority when they were gathered together. It was only later, when they were tested individually, that they responded as the minority had done, shifting their judgments by moving the boundary between blue and green toward the green of the color spectrum. Researchers have also studied minority influence in the context of simulated jury deliberations, where a disagreeing minority prevents unanimous acceptance of the majority point of view. The minority group was never well-liked, and its persuasiveness, when it occurred, worked only gradually, over time. The vocal minority was most influential when it had four qualities. It persisted in affirming a consistent position, appeared confident, avoided seeming rigid and dogmatic, and was skilled in social influence. Eventually, the power of the many may be undercut by the persuasion of the dedicated few. How do these qualities of a dissident minority, especially its persistence, help to sway the majority? Majority decisions tend to be made without engaging the systematic thought and critical thinking skills of the individuals in the group. Given the force of the group's normative power to shape the opinions of the followers who conform without thinking things through, they are often taken at face value. The persistent minority forces the others to process the relevant information more mindfully. Research shows that the decisions of a group as a whole are more thoughtful and creative when there is minority dissent than when it is absent. If a minority can win adherence to their side, even when they are wrong, there is hope for a minority with a valid cause. In society, the majority tends to be the defender of the status quo, while the force for innovation and change comes from the minority members, or individuals either dissatisfied with the current system or able to visualize new and creative alternative ways of dealing with current problems. According to the French social theorist Serge Moscovici, the conflict between the entrenched majority view and the dissident minority perspective is an essential precondition of innovation and revolution that can lead to positive social change. An individual is constantly engaged in a two-way exchange with society, adapting to its norms, roles, and status prescriptions, but also acting upon society to reshape those norms. Blind obedience to authority. Milgram's shocking research. I was trying to think of a way to make Ash's conformity experiment more humanly significant. I was dissatisfied that the test of conformity was judgments about lines. I wondered whether groups could pressure a person into performing an act whose human import was more readily apparent, perhaps behaving aggressively toward another person, say by administering increasingly severe shocks to him. But to study the group effect, you'd have to know how the subject performed without any group pressure. At that instant, my thought shifted, zeroing in on this experimental control. Just how far would a person go under the experimenter's orders? These musings from a former teaching and research assistant of Solomon Ash started a remarkable series of studies by a social psychologist, Stanley Milgram, that have come to be known as investigations of blind obedience to authority. His interest in the problem of obedience to authority came from deep personal concerns about how readily the Nazis had obediently killed Jews during the Holocaust. My laboratory paradigm gave scientific expression to a more general concern about authority, a concern forced upon members of my generation, in particular upon Jews, such as myself, by the atrocities of World War II. The impact of the Holocaust on my own psyche energized my interest in obedience and shaped the particular form in which it was examined. I would like to recreate for you the situation faced by a typical volunteer in this research project, then go on to summarize the results, outline 10 important lessons to be drawn from this research that can be generalized to other situations of behavioral transformations in everyday life, and then review extensions of this paradigm by providing a number of real-world parallels. Milgram's obedience paradigm. Imagine that you see the following advertisement in the Sunday newspaper and decide to apply. The original study involved only men, but women were used in a later study, so I invite all readers to participate in this imagined scenario. Public announcement. We will pay you $4 for 1 hour of your time. Persons needed for a study of memory. We will pay 500 New Haven men to help us complete a scientific study of memory and learning. The study is being done at Yale University. Each person who participates will be paid $4 plus 50 cents car fare for approximately 1 hour's time. We need you for only 1 hour. There are no further obligations. You may choose the time you would like to come, evenings, weekdays, or weekends. No special training, education, or experience is needed. We want factory workers, city employees, laborers, barbers, businessmen, clerks, professional people, telephone workers, construction workers, salespeople, white-collar workers, others. All persons must be between the ages of 20 and 50. High school and college students cannot be used. If you meet the qualifications, fill out the coupon below and mail it now to Professor Stanley Milgram, Department of Psychology, Yale University, New Haven. You will be notified later of the specific time and place of the study. We reserve the right to decline any application. You will be paid $4 plus 50 cents car fare as soon as you arrive at the laboratory. To Professor Stanley Milgram, Department of Psychology, Yale University, New Haven, Connecticut. I want to take part in this study of memory and learning. I am between the ages of 20 and 50. I will be paid $4 plus 50 cents car fare if I participate. A researcher whose serious demeanor and gray laboratory coat convey scientific importance greets you and another applicant at your arrival at a Yale University laboratory in Lindsay Chittenden Hall. You are here to help scientific psychology find ways to improve people's learning and memory through the use of punishment. He tells you why this new research may have important practical consequences. The task is straightforward. One of you will be the teacher who gives the learner a set of word pairings to memorize. During the test, the teacher gives each key word, and the learner must respond with the correct association. When right, the teacher gives a verbal reward, such as good or that's right. When wrong, the teacher is to press a lever on an impressive-looking shock apparatus that delivers an immediate shock to punish the error. The shock generator has 30 switches, starting from a low level of 15 volts and increasing by 15 volts at each higher level. The experimenter tells you that every time the learner makes a mistake, you have to press the next higher voltage switch. The control panel indicates both the voltage level of each of the switches and a corresponding description of the level. The 10th level, 150 volts, is strong shock. The 13th level, 195 volts, is very strong shock. The 17th level, 255 volts, is intense shock. The 21st level, 315 volts, is extremely intense shock. The 25th level, 375 volts, is danger, severe shock. And at the 29th and 30th levels, 435 and 450 volts, the control panel is simply marked with an ominous XXX, the pornography of ultimate pain and power. You and another volunteer draw straws to see who will play each role. You are to be the teacher, and the other volunteer will be the learner. The drawing is rigged, and the other volunteer is a confederate of the experimenter who always plays the learner. He is a mild-mannered, middle-aged man whom you help escort to the next chamber. Okay, now we're going to set up the learner so he can get some punishment, the researcher tells you both. The learner's arms are strapped down, and an electrode is attached to his right wrist. The shock generator in the next room will deliver the shocks to the learner, if and when he makes any errors. The two of you communicate over the intercom with the experimenter standing next to you. You get a sample shock of 45 volts, the third level, a slight tingly pain, so you now have a sense of what the shock levels mean. The experimenter then signals the start of your trial of the memory improvement study. Initially, your pupil does well, but soon he begins making errors, and you start pressing the shock switches. He complains that the shocks are starting to hurt. You look at the experimenter, who nods to continue. As the shock levels increase in intensity, so do the learner's screams, saying he does not think he wants to continue. You hesitate and question whether you should go on, but the experimenter insists that you have no choice but to do so. Now the learner begins complaining about his heart condition, and you dissent, but the experimenter still insists that you continue. Errors galore. You plead with your pupil to concentrate to get the right associations. You don't want to hurt him with these very high-level, intense shocks. But your concerns and motivational messages are to no avail. He gets the answers wrong again and again. As the shocks intensify, he shouts out, "I can't stand the pain! Let me out of here!" Then he says to the experimenter, "You have no right to keep me here! Let me out!" Another level up, he screams, "I absolutely refuse to answer anymore! Get me out of here! You can't hold me here. My heart's bothering me." Obviously, you want nothing more to do with this experiment. You tell the experimenter that you refuse to continue. You are not the kind of person who harms other people in this way. You want out. But the experimenter continues to insist that you go on. He reminds you of the contract, of your agreement to participate fully. Moreover, he claims responsibility for the consequences of your shocking actions. After you press the 300-volt switch, you read the next keyword, but the learner doesn't answer. "He's not responding," you tell the experimenter. You want him to go into the other room and check on the learner to see if he is all right. The experimenter is impassive. He is not going to check on the learner. Instead, he tells you, "If the learner doesn't answer in a reasonable time, about 5 seconds, consider it wrong, since errors of omission must be punished in the same way as errors of commission. That is a rule." As you continue up to even more dangerous shock levels, there is no sound coming from your pupil's shock chamber. He may be unconscious, or worse. You are really distressed and want to quit, but nothing you say works to get your exit from this unexpectedly distressing situation. You are told to follow the rules and keep posing the test items and shocking the errors. Now try to imagine fully what your participation as the teacher would be. I'm sure you're saying, "No way would I ever go all the way." Obviously, you would have dissented, then disobeyed, and just walked out. You would never sell out your morality for $4. But had you actually gone all the way to the last of the 30th shock levels, the experimenter would have insisted that you repeat the XXX switch 2 more times for good measure. Now that is really rubbing it in your face. Forget it. No, sir. No way. You're out of there, right? So how far up the scale do you predict that you would go before exiting? How far would the average person from this small city go in this situation? The outcome predicted by expert judges. Milgram described his experiment to a group of 40 psychiatrists and then asked them to estimate the percentage of American citizens who would go to each of the 30 levels in this experiment. On average, they predicted that less than 1% would go all the way to the end, that only sadists would engage in such sadistic behavior, and that most people would drop out at the 10th level of 150 volts. They could not have been more wrong. These experts on human behavior were totally wrong because, first, they ignored the situational determinants of behavior in the procedural description of the experiment. Second, their training in traditional psychiatry led them to rely too heavily on the dispositional perspective to understand unusual behavior and to disregard situational factors. They were guilty of making the fundamental attribution error, FAE. The shocking truth. In fact, in Milgram's experiment, 2 of every 3, 65% of the volunteers, went all the way up to the maximum shock level of 450 volts. The vast majority of people, the teachers, shocked their learner victim over and over again, despite his increasingly desperate pleas to stop. And now I invite you to venture another guess. What was the dropout rate after the shock level reached 330 volts, with only silence coming from the shock chamber, where the learner could reasonably be presumed to be unconscious?